Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Monday, September 20th, 2021. I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi. Monday's weather in Dubuque will be not as warm, with an afternoon thunderstorm or two, a high of 80 and an overnight low of 55. On the front page of Monday's Telegraph Herald is an article by John Cruz titled, Dubuque Looks to Boost Seasonal Workforce. Official says there was a lack of applicants for summer positions, forcing the city to adjust how it offers services. With the last rays of summer now setting, City of Dubuque officials are considering new strategies to boost recruitment for their struggling seasonal workforce. Throughout the summer, city officials struggled to reach adequate seasonal staffing levels for their pool facilities and summer recreation programs, prompting the city to reduce maximum participant numbers for programs and cut pool hours. Dan Kroger, Recreation Division Manager for the city, said the Leisure Services Department hovered between 50% and 60% of its ideal summer workforce throughout the summer, despite several efforts to boost recruitment. Quote, "For the bulk of our staff, we saw a lack of applicants for positions," Kroger said. "It forced us to think outside the box and adjust with how we were offering our services," end quote. Workforce shortages have pervaded the entire tri-state area, with numerous businesses struggling to reach full employment. The city, also hit by the shortage, had its seasonal employee numbers cut even more dramatically with the start of the school year, forcing Dubuque's city pools to close about 2 weeks early. Though summer now is largely behind them, Kroger said he and other city officials already are exploring potential strategies for preventing a similar shortage next year. Quote, "We've recognized this is a challenge in our field nationally," he said. "We're going to have conversations with ourselves and out-of-the-box thinking on ways that we can improve things," end quote. Kroger said the city is examining a number of potential barriers that prospective employees may face and ways those barriers could be remedied, such as subsidizing lifeguard certification fees. Wages also will be examined. Currently, seasonal employee wages range from $10 to $19 per hour. Kroger said lifeguard wages recently were increased from a little more than $10 per hour to $12 per hour, though the city did not see an increase in lifeguard applications as a result. Quote, "We'll be looking at if our current wages are attractive enough," he said. "We didn't see much of an impact when we raised lifeguard wages, but we're hoping we'll have more success next year when we can advertise it more," end quote. Kroger said the city also is exploring potential collaborations with other organizations to develop collaborative efforts to increase the seasonal workforce. Amy Hawkins, Chief Human Resources Officer for the Dubuque Community School District, said the city and the district have begun early conversations about incentives that could encourage students to take on seasonal work. Quote, "Everyone is looking for ways to increase their workforce, and we are always looking for ways to encourage partners and community organizations to help with that," she said. "Everyone is going to the drawing board," end quote. Kroger said a number of strategies have been suggested, including potentially offering school credit for students who take up seasonal positions with the city. Quote, "The logistics of those things are being explored," he said. "Maybe there is a way to work with gym teachers and offer some credits," end quote. Kroger stressed that none of the proposals being discussed among staff are being actively implemented currently, but he and other city officials intend to have some strategies implemented in time for next summer. Quote, "Our goal is to get back to the norm, so our hope is to have something in place by then," Kroger said. "Right now, we are at the whiteboard, exploring what all our options are," end quote. Olivia Garrett of the Telegraph Herald writes, Piasta landowners weigh in on planned unit development. Residents in the proposed district share their concerns about the city's rezoning rights. City of Piasta officials have an eye on the city's long-term future, but the complexities of zoning for that future recently went on display. During a Piasta City Council meeting, more than 40 people attended a series of public hearings related to rezoning and a potential planned unit development in an area south of Birds Road. Landowners in the proposed planned unit development who were annexed into Piasta last year expressed opposition and dissatisfaction with communication. PUDs are zoning districts that encourage development meeting public needs with a variety of building types and land uses outside of traditional zoning rules. The city approved a comprehensive plan and parks master plan in May, outlining goals that include the development of a city center and central activity district. In July, consultants RDG Planning and Design presented a vision for Water's Edge, an area the city believes could someday become a town center. The comprehensive plan identifies a PUD as a way to ensure future development aligns with those goals. The area is between Birds Road, US 20, and Cox Springs Road. The land currently is primarily agriculture, though it also includes Piasta Mini Storage. A future land use map adopted in May shows the area becoming a central activity district with a park, new streets, and greenways. Current landowners, including Birds Family Investments Limited Partnership, Deb McDonough, owner of Piasta Mini Storage, and Mary Ann Kalb, who lives in the proposed PUD, shared their concerns at the meeting about what a PUD would mean for them. The area was annexed into the city in October 2020 and zoned as an A1 agricultural district. Because McDonough's business predates annexation, she is allowed to continue operating as she has been, but she cannot expand her business without having her land switched to a commercial zoning classification. However, if the area around the storage business develops as proposed, it would lie in the path of a natural extension of Bellow Drive. In July, McDonough applied for her property to be rezoned to a general commercial district. The Planning and Zoning Commission had recommended the City Council accept the rezoning request. However, council members tabled McDonough's request at their meeting. Councilmember John Kraft suggested the city continue working with McDonough to see if they can find a feasible solution for both her and city officials' desires. Three letters written by Kalb, Gary and Terry Birds, and McDonough, who also spoke in person, were read in opposition to a PUD. Quote, "We, as the owners of the property, contend the city cannot impose this PUD that designates land for public use without first owning the property or having a stated plan to do so," Gary Birds said following the meeting. During the meeting, Mayor Jim Merton noted that development does not require the city to own the land. Quote, "Individual people own land, individual people sell land, developers buy land, and they develop land," Merton said. "All that the city is doing is putting a zoning ordinance in place that says these are the restrictions on how it can be developed," end quote. Merton also clarified that the City Council has not yet voted on the issue. Merton described a continual process of seeking feedback and then refining plans. Quote, "Somehow between the last feedback stage and this one, this has become adversarial," Merton said. "But no action has been taken on the PUD by this council, nor has there been action threatened," end quote. Merton said during the meeting that the city will continue to work with the community. Following the meeting, Kraft agreed, quote, "Our goal is to make sure this plan is amicable to everyone involved," Kraft said. Elizabeth Kelsey writes, "Local volunteers spread lasagna love. Nonprofit started in March 2020 and has expanded to all 50 states and Puerto Rico. Every week, Victoria Scott makes dinner for people she doesn't know. As a volunteer chef with an international effort called Lasagna Love, the Dubuque resident bakes 3 to 5 lasagnas each week and delivers them to local residents who have requested a hot meal. Quote, "For whatever reason, they would like a lasagna delivered," Scott said. "It's nice to be a part of that and to play a role in someone else's dinner," end quote. The Lasagna Love Initiative started in San Diego in March 2020 and since has become a nonprofit operating in all 50 states and Puerto Rico, recently expanding to Australia and Canada. More than 100,000 lasagnas have been delivered in that time, with more than 20,000 volunteers now baking and distributing meals to neighbors in need. Scott, who recently moved to Dubuque from California, is helping launch the local Lasagna Love movement. As regional leader for the Dubuque area, she conducts outreach and recruitment efforts and matches chefs with individuals who have requested lasagnas. Of course, she also bakes and distributes dishes of her own. Quote, "It's a bit addicting once you get going," she said, laughing. Scott said individuals can request a lasagna for any reason, whether that be financial hardship, food insecurity, or overwhelmed parents who would like a night off from cooking. Chefs follow their own lasagna recipes, sometimes tailoring it to the dietary preferences or allergies of recipients. Scott said volunteers can offer other meals. She has delivered chicken dishes in the past, but lasagna is the program's staple supper. Currently, the Dubuque area has 3 volunteer chefs, a number Scott hopes to expand. Michelle Olson of Hazel Green, Wisconsin, is a new chef. After a Facebook friend in another state posted about her work with Lasagna Love, Olson decided to sign up. Quote, "I didn't know how long it would take to get a match because I didn't know how many people in the area even knew about Lasagna Love, but I got a match my 2nd week," she said. On Sunday, she was scheduled to go to Darlington, Wisconsin to deliver her first lasagna. Volunteers can bake and deliver lasagnas according to their schedule, just one time, once a month, or multiple pans per week. Olson has signed up for 1 lasagna each week and is open to doing more if needed. Quote, "Lasagna Love was a way to provide love and kindness through a home-baked meal, and what's better than that," she said. Scott said needs that arose during the COVID-19 pandemic played a role in the creation of Lasagna Love, but she believes the initiative will persist beyond that. Quote, "That need has always been there," she said. "I think this program is here to stay," end quote. Interested in getting involved? If you would like to request a lasagna or sign up to cook one for a neighbor, please visit lasagnalove.org. Turning to news from the tri-state area, Kaylee Reese writes, EDCO schools invite public to learn about bond measure. Voters in the Edgewood-Colesburg Community School District will have a chance in the coming weeks to learn about a bond measure that will be on their ballots later this year. The district's school board recently unanimously voted to place a $12 million bond measure on the ballot in the November 2nd election, Superintendent Rob Bush said. Voters can attend several upcoming community meetings to learn more. Meetings on Tuesday, September 21st, and on October 28th will be held at the junior-senior high school in Edgewood, and a meeting on October 12th will be held at the elementary school in Colesburg. All of the events start at 6 p.m. Quote, "It's just a chance to have questions or concerns answered," Bush said. "A lot of people have questions about how this affects their taxes. Hopefully by that time, we'll be able to answer some of those and explain the process," end quote. He said the bond measure likely, quote, "won't raise taxes that much," end quote, but the exact amount still is being discussed. If the measure is approved, funds would go towards several school projects, Bush said, including updating the elementary school's heating system and adding air conditioning to the building. Quote, "The heating system at the elementary school is getting fairly aged," he said. "Depending on who you talk to, it's got 5 to 10 years left." At the secondary school, officials hope to move the pickup and drop-off location that currently sits next to the highway. District officials also want to create more secure entrances at the school. The district's buses also cannot all fit inside the current bus barn, he said, so the bond would also help fund building a new bus barn at the current location of the aging secondary shop and technical education center. Dan Van Tyker, the school board president, said the secondary school would get a new competition gym and technical center should the measure pass. He said a new tech center would provide more opportunities for students to earn college credits in high school. Quote, "I think that's something the community is really excited about," he said. "For us, being a local, rural area, there's a lot of hands-on opportunities, and having this facility would be a good thing," end quote. Van Tyker said a new technical center was not on the 2 previously failed bond measures. In February 2017, a $9.6 million bond measure fell just short of the 60% approval needed to pass. Voters also rejected a $7 million bond measure in September 2017, with just 41% of votes in favor. Van Tyker said the current board proposal is the only one of the 3 school board unanimously approved bringing to voters, and he encouraged people to come to the upcoming meetings. Quote, "The goal of these is, 1, to get everyone aware of the vote, but also, 2, making sure they have all the facts before voting," he said. In the area news in brief section of Monday's Telegraph Herald, motorcyclist injured in Joe Davies County crash. A motorcyclist was injured in a crash Friday afternoon in Joe Davies County. James Villa, aged 40, of Timberlake, North Carolina, was transported by ambulance to FHN Memorial Hospital, Freeport, for treatment of non-life-threatening injuries, according to the Joe Davies County Sheriff's Department. A press release states that Villa was operating a motorcycle west on US 20 near Summit Drive in rural Stockton at 3:12 p.m. when he failed to negotiate a curve and the motorcycle left the roadway and overturned. Maquoketa venue to postpone disco night. An event will be postponed at a Maquoketa venue due to rising COVID-19 numbers. Onward Fine Arts Center announced it will postpone its disco night slated for 7 p.m. on October 9th. The show will be rescheduled at a later date. Patrons who already have purchased tickets can contact Onward Fine Arts Center to exchange for any upcoming show. More information is available by calling 563-652-9815. Event to offer look at Dyersville Innovation Lab. Dyersville community members can get a look at the progress at a new innovation lab during an upcoming event. The Dyersville Innovation Lab sneak peek event will take place at 5 p.m. Thursday, September 23rd at the lab, 248 First Avenue East, according to an online announcement. Refreshments will be available during the event and a short program will begin at 5:15 p.m. The lab will offer a co-working space, meeting space, and innovation services. Art Tour receives national recognition. A travel guide to the tri-state area artist-oriented destinations has been selected for presentation this month at a summit organized by a rural sustainability and idea-sharing network. All River Road Talent, a collection of local artists, will showcase a scenic art loop map at the Radically Rural National Summit in Keene, New Hampshire, according to a press release. The guide showcases artists in Northwest Illinois, Northeast Iowa, and Southwest Wisconsin. More information is available at the website scenicartloop.com. Monday's installment of the Love That Lasts series focuses on a Dubuque couple who complement each other, value, faith, and family. Bill and Betty Fritz first met through a mutual friend in 1952. In 1952, Betty Cool met a young Korean War veteran named Bill Fritz. Bill, who had just returned from a year in the service, was friends with John Grotkin, the young man who happened to be dating Betty's sister Dorothy. One day, Grotkin got to offer Betty a ride and promised to introduce her to his friend. Quote, "Bill was real nice looking with black hair and a nice smile," Betty said. I said, "Oh boy, that sounds good." Afterwards, I thought, "I hope he liked me, because that would be a good guy to go out with," end quote. He was shy, but it soon became clear that he liked Betty as much as she liked him. The Dubuque couple now has been married for 67 years. Betty and Bill went together to movies and stock car races when they were dating. In 1953, Dorothy and John Grotkin were married. Betty and Bill were in the wedding party. A year later, on August 21, 1954, the two couples switched places. Betty, then 22, and Bill, then 23, were married at Holy Ghost Church in Dubuque. Devoted members of the parish, Betty and Bill were regular faces helping at Holy Ghost bingo nights for 40 years. The couple enjoyed supper clubs, picnics that included games of volleyball, card games, and time spent with friends and family. Quote, "I have a temper, and he puts up with it most of the time, but eventually he'll speak up too," Betty said. "We had to learn to talk to each other and be more patient," end quote. Betty worked at Dubuque Packing Company before their first daughter, Jane Lutzinger, was born 10 minutes before their second wedding anniversary. Quote, "Other girls were all having babies, and I thought, ain't I ever going to get a baby," Betty said. "I thought if I had one baby, I'd have another. It never happened." 12 years after Lutschinger, the family adopted their second daughter, Tammy Conrad. Their first house on Elm Street in Dubuque featured a large garden that kept them busy with tomatoes, beans, and raspberries. Later, they lived on Delmonico Drive. Eventually, Betty went back to work, serving hot lunches at Dubuque Community Schools for 18 years. Bill worked for Continental Baking Company for more than 30 years. Bill's work woke him up early at 3 a.m. When he got back from making deliveries in Epworth, Cascade, and Anamosa before the stores there opened, he would help around the house and with dinner. In retirement, Bill enjoyed fishing and volunteering with St. Vincent de Paul Society. In recent years, Bill and Betty have slowed down. They have lived at Oak Park Place, a senior living facility, for 6 years, where their refrigerator is covered in pictures and handmade cards from the grandchildren. They have 5 grandchildren and 7 great-grandchildren. Quote, "I had my day," Bill said. Quote, "That's his saying," Lutschinger said. "I had my day of having fun," end quote. Throughout the marriage, Bill doted on Betty. Showering his wife with flowers and gifts for every occasion has always been important to him, but nowadays it's often Betty who takes care of Bill. Quote, "For years, he was the one to take care of things when she was running around all the time," Lutschinger said. "Now she does more to care for him," end quote. "Faith is important to the family," Lutschinger said. Quote, "We always kept our prayers going," Betty said. And this article is accompanied by a photograph of Bill and Betty Fritz on their wedding day on August 21st, 1954, and today as they sit outside Oak Park Place in Dubuque. Let's turn now to the opinion page of Monday's Telegraph Herald. It includes an Other View column written by Scott Reeder for the Telegraph Herald. Reeder is a veteran statehouse journalist and a freelance reporter based in Springfield, Illinois. His column is titled, "Remembering a Child and a Lost Childhood." "I find myself grieving for someone I've never met every September 17th for the past 31 years. Back in 1990, I was working as the night police reporter for the Quad City Times when I was dispatched to a fire at a school playground at 9 p.m. I was one of the first on the scene. I walked to where I saw smoke rising from some tall weeds on the edge of the playground, looked down, and was met with the body of a child that had been doused with gasoline and set on fire. I staggered backward, gasping for air. I could feel the bile rise in my throat and my knees go weak. It was the last thing I expected to find on a crisp autumn evening in Davenport, Iowa. I was there when the firefighters, the detectives, the medical examiner, and a horde of reporters arrived. As I stood a few feet from the smoldering remains, wondering, who could do such a thing? What evil lurked in the shadows that committed such an act? We later learned that the victim was Jennifer Ann Lewis, a pugnacious tomboy from Rock Island, Illinois. She was last seen buying gum from a neighborhood store. She never came back. Year after year, I've learned a bit more about this girl, and the more I learn, the sadder I become. I've wondered what her life would have been like if she had lived. A teacher's aide told me how Jennifer liked to twirl around in frilly dresses, hiking the hem higher and higher as she spun. Her best friend told me how they played with My Little Ponies together. Her mother recalled her daughter's sweet disposition, how she loved her newborn baby brother and her dog, Bowser. We name buildings after wealthy benefactors, bridges after politicians, and streets after celebrities, but our collective recollection of children who die at the hands of others fades. A granite monument funded by the community was placed on the playground where Jennifer's corpse was found. A while back, I went looking for it, only to learn vandals long ago destroyed it. Even in death, she isn't accorded the respect her life was due. No one that night walked away from that schoolyard unchanged. One former police lieutenant froze on the witness stand years later as he suffered a flashback to that horrible night. A police sergeant, who I knew well, had a fit of rage years later when Jennifer's name was evoked. A corporal at that scene descended into alcoholism. For me, slumber was elusive for weeks following that fateful night. Another reporter who was there confessed to her teenage sons decades later that it is the one image from her journalism career that she can't rid her mind of. During the past 5 years, I spent much time researching the case. I found myself interviewing vagrants beneath underpasses in New Orleans, knocking on doors of Mississippi shacks, and wading through thousands of pages of Iowa court documents. I now know much more, but am I any closer to understanding? Well, I certainly don't understand what would possess someone to commit such evil. I produced a podcast on the case, and Jennifer's name is now known by many. I want to write a book about the crime, but each time I sit down to write, I'm met with the image of a buck-toothed smile and the unassuming brown eyes of a child who never turned 10. That photo haunts me. To this youngster, whom I've never met, I can only promise your memory will not be lost. A man is serving a life sentence for her murder. He's been tried 4 times for the same crime, 3 convictions and 1 hung jury. His appeals continue. Although 3 juries have found him guilty, when I think of Jennifer, I prefer to think of innocence. I think of a child without guile who was raped, strangled, and burned. I think of a youngster who ran down school hallways telling teachers and classmates alike about her upcoming birthday. She just didn't know that was the day she would be buried. Again, this is a column written by Scott Reeder for the Telegraph Herald. Monday's Telegraph Herald opinion page also includes a column by Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune titled, "Gymnasts Not the Only Ones Who Can Become, Quote, Lost in the Air," end quote. As I watched Simone Biles and 3 other U.S. Olympic gymnasts tell a Senate committee on how badly their complaints of sexual abuse had been handled by the FBI, I was reminded of the day Biles abruptly withdrew from her event at this summer's Tokyo Olympics. The multiple gold medal winner cited so-called mental health reasons, but fortunately bounced back into Olympic competition later. But her explanation at a news conference that she got, quote, a little bit lost in the air, end quote, stuck with me. I learned about something called the twisties, a gymnast's term for a mid-air moment during their aerial jumps, twists, and turns when they suddenly and uncontrollably lose awareness of where the heck they are in their routine. Indeed, as I watched her and her fellow medal-winning gymnasts Michaela Maroney, Allie Raisman, and Maggie Nichols share their horrific and heartbreaking stories of sexual abuse by since-convicted team doctor Larry Nassar, it was painfully obvious that gymnasts aren't the only ones who get lost in the air. Behind the glitter and glory of the grand games lurked one of the biggest child sex scandals in American history. Hundreds of girls and women, including most of the 2012 and 2016 U.S. Olympic women's gymnastics teams, were molested by Nassar, who is now serving what amounts to life in prison for multiple sex crimes. Now, as the young women's testimony made painfully clear, we need to demand answers to a lot more questions about the FBI and the sports system that failed to protect them, including USA Gymnastics, the sport's official governing body, and the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee. Quote, "To be clear, I blame Larry Nassar," Biles said tearfully, "and I also blame an entire system that enabled and perpetrated his abuse," end quote. Maroney, an Olympian in 2012, offered graphic examples of Nassar's repeated abuses, including a harrowing ordeal with Nassar, quote, "molesting me for hours," end quote, when they were in Tokyo for a competition. But compounding her mental and physical abuse, she said, was the apparent indifference she heard on the other end of the line in 2015, when she was 19 years old and reporting her ordeal to the FBI, before she even told her mother what Nassar had done. She said the agent's response was, quote, "Is that all?" end quote. Worse, she said, the FBI didn't document her charges for 17 months in a report that also made false claims about what she had said. But a new day of reckoning might be upon us, thanks in part to the women who courageously came forward to report Nassar's abuses. Maroney's allegations appear to be supported by a July report from the Department of Justice's Inspector General that details failures of the FBI's Indianapolis field office in its response to allegations against Nassar. Michael Langeman, the agent who interviewed Maroney, was fired a week before the hearing, according to news reports, and his former boss, Jay Abbott, retired in 2018. FBI Director Christopher Wray, who became the director after the Nassar case was bungled, apologized for the, quote, "totally unacceptable," end quote, failures in his agency. That's good, for starters. But more questions need to be asked about the failures of what Biles called, quote, the system, end quote, that failed to protect the girls and young women who, along with their parents, trusted it. The gymnasts said they felt particularly pained by the knowledge that so many other girls and young women were encouraged to follow their path into gymnastics, only to be betrayed. Yes, it's not only gymnasts who get the so-called twisties. Sometimes the people we trust to look out for their interests can be, quote, more than a little bit lost in the air, end quote, too. Again, this is the opinion of Clarence Page, recipient of the Pulitzer Prize in 1989 and a Chicago Tribune columnist and editorial board member. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Monday, September 20th, 2021 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Mark T. Martin, aged 87, of Eastman, Wisconsin, died Friday, September 17th. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, September 21st, with a rosary service at 3:45 p.m. at Garrity Funeral Home in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, and from 10 to 11 a.m. Wednesday, September 21st, at St. Wenceslaus Catholic Church in Eastman. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday at the church. Florence B. Wall, aged 100, of Cuba City, died Saturday, September 18th. Visitation will be held from 9 to 10:30 a.m. Friday, September 24th, at Casey McNett Funeral Home in Cuba City. Services will be held at 11 a.m. Friday at St. Francis de Sales Church in Hazel Green, Wisconsin. Robert B. Farmer, age 90, of Worthington, Iowa, died Sunday, September 19th. Visitation will be held from 4 to 8 p.m. Tuesday, September 21st, at Rife Funeral Home in Dyersville. Complete arrangements are pending. Funeral service announcements include those for Heather L. Balk of Dubuque, with visitation 2 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, September 22nd, at Bear Funeral Home, with a service at 10 a.m. Thursday, September 23rd, at the funeral home. Services for Norma R. Bildstein of Dyersville include visitation 3 to 8 p.m. today, Monday, September 20th, and 8:45 to 9:45 a.m. Tuesday, September 21st, at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. Service will be 10:30 a.m. Tuesday at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville. Visitation for Virgil M. Brote of Fenimore, Wisconsin, is 4 to 7 p.m. today, Monday, September 20th, at Larson Family Funeral Home in Fenimore, with service at 11 a.m. Tuesday, September 21st, at the Fenimore United Methodist Church. Visitation for Merle C. Curtis of Cuba City, Wisconsin, will be 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, September 25th, at the United Methodist Church in Cuba City. Service will be 11 a.m. Saturday at the church. Visitation for Maximo C. Damaso of Dubuque, 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, September 27th, at Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory. Mass of Christian burial will be 10 a.m. Tuesday, September 28th, at St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Church. Visitation for Mary A. Davis of Dubuque is 9 to 11 a.m. Friday, September 24th, at Church of the Resurrection. Mass of Christian burial will be 11 a.m. Friday at the church. Visitation for Carol A. Gleichner of East Dubuque, Illinois, will be 9 to 11 a.m. Tuesday, September 21st, at Bear Funeral Home. Service, 11 a.m. Tuesday, at the funeral home. Visitation for Marilyn A. Heinz of Dubuque will be 9 to 10:45 a.m. Wednesday, September 22nd, at St. Patrick's Church, with service at 11 a.m. Wednesday at the church. Let's turn now to the sports section of Monday's Telegraph Herald. The lead article is written by Jim Leitner and titled, Saints Eager to Start Regular Season Thursday. This focuses on the United States Hockey League. Greg Brown experienced a nice mix of success and teachable moments in his first preseason as the Dubuque Fighting Saints head coach. Now the games begin to count. The Saints went 3-1 in the preseason and outscored their opponents 19-10. They open the regular season at 1:30 p.m. Thursday against Tri-City at the USHL Fall Classic in Cranberry Township, Pennsylvania. Quote, I like the progress we've made, Brown said Saturday night. With each game, we've advanced in different areas and become more of a complete team. Obviously, we have many more steps to go, but over the four games we've experienced a lot of improvement, which is what you want to see at this point in the process. The effort they've put in during camp has been really good. They're hungry to get better and they're hungry to learn. We've been fortunate to have those teachable moments in the preseason instead of later in the year. The guys have addressed them, and we can check them off the list, end quote. That showed this weekend. After a 2-1 loss to Cedar Rapids on Friday night, Brown and assistants Justin Hale and Evan Dixon emphasized net front presence. Less than 24 hours later, traffic in front of the Cedar Rapids net played a key role in a 6-3 victory. Quote, the team looks better and better the more we play, and that shows in how well we bounced back from Friday night, veteran forward Tristan Lemire said. Everything was better, our special teams, our communication, our breakout. Having those teachable moments gets us more prepared for the regular season. You'd rather have them now than when the season starts. It shows a lot about the character of this team that we're learning from those mistakes and making the adjustments to get better, end quote. It's still a work in progress, though, and stiffer challenges await at the Fall Classic. The Saints also play Omaha on Friday before returning home. Quote, there were a lot of really positive things to come out of the preseason, but we realize there are areas of our game we still have to clean up, veteran defenseman Max Burkholder said. A lot of it is just the little things you have to do well to be successful, like our breakout, our forecheck, our communication, and faceoffs. We feel pretty confident about going to the Fall Classic, but we know we're going to have to play well defensively against two really good teams. We're excited to get going, end quote. The Saints' best defense might be its puck control offense. Dubuque dominated at times this weekend simply by keeping the puck away from the Rough Riders and waiting for scoring chances. Quote, we train at a very high tempo in practice every day, so when we get to the games we play against teams that don't play at a high tempo, things go a lot smoother, said defenseman Samuel Scholand, a Dallas Stars prospect. Quote, we're used to that pace. That's something Coach Brown emphasizes. We create those habits in training, which makes it a little easier to execute them during the game, end quote. The Saints reached the 25-man roster limit this weekend by trading Christopher Lynch to Fargo and Primo Self to Youngstown for conditional draft picks. In the local and area sports roundup, Luter sparks UWP to 5-0 win. Amber Luter scored a pair of goals Sunday afternoon to lead the University of Wisconsin-Platteville women's soccer team to a 5-0 non-conference win over visiting Nebraska Wesleyan. Luter opened the scoring 7 minutes 52 seconds into the game and scored again at the 60-minute 45-second mark to put the Pioneers ahead 4-0. In between, Lauren Lodico and Alyssa Peterson found the back of the net. Lily Roche added another insurance goal in the 82nd minute. Platteville outshot Nebraska Wesleyan 34-6. Emma Ball and Annalie Erickson made 2 saves apiece for the Pioneers. Loras 3, Illinois Wesleyan 2 in 2 overtimes. At Loras, Abby Erickson scored in the second overtime to lift the Duhawks. Her second goal of the contest came in the 104th minute. Caitlin Farrell also scored for the Duhawks, who now stand at 6-0-1. Kendall Kells made 6 saves to earn the victory in goal. In men's college soccer, Loras topped Millikan 4-0. Alex Beausoleil scored a pair of insurance goals as the Duhawks won late Saturday to improve their record to 5-1-1. Patrick Clancy gave the Duhawks the lead in the 10th minute, and Juan José Arias Mondragon doubled the lead 10 minutes later. In prep cross country, Leicht wins Heartland. At Pella, Derek Leicht ran a 15:37.2 to win the 16th annual Heartland Cross Country Classic on Saturday. He finished more than 3 seconds ahead of Iowa City West's Alex McCain. Millard West of Nebraska won the 42-team event, and Hempstead placed sixth with 284 points. This week's finalists for Athlete of the Week include Logan Drone of River Ridge, Wisconsin. The River Ridge quarterback accounted for 6 touchdowns in a 41-3 victory over Southwestern. The quarterback tossed 3 touchdowns while rushing for scores of 41, 10, and 58 yards. Ian Adrian caught touchdown passes of 29 and 85 yards from Drone, while Matthew Neese hauled in a 32-yard score. Another finalist is Kyle Conrady of Dubuque Senior. The Dubuque Senior junior kicker made a 46-yard field goal on Friday night in a 41-14 victory over Waterloo West at Dalzell Field. It is tied for the 4th longest field goal in Iowa this season. Conrady leads the state regardless of class with 6 field goals made and with 8 field goals attempted. The 3rd finalist is Haley Stitch of Cuba City. The senior outside hitter, a 4-year starter and 3-time All-SWAL first team selection, leads the conference with 166 kills and ranks 2nd with 131 digs. She tallied 89 kills, 8 aces, and 63 digs in 2 league matches and the Edgerton tournament. Stitch recorded her 1,000th career dig while making the all-tournament team. To cast your vote for Logan Drone of River Ridge, Wisconsin, Kyle Conrady of Dubuque Senior, or Haley Stitch of Cuba City, visit the website telegraphherald.com/athlete. Between 12:01 a.m. Monday and 5 p.m. Tuesday. Today's local events include Prep Boys Golf, Western Dubuque at Pleasant Valley Invitational, 2:30 p.m. Dubuque Hempstead plays at the Gardner Invitational at 3:15. Dubuque Senior plays at the Twin Pines Invite, 3:15 p.m. Dubuque Wallert plays at the Meadows Invite, 3:15 p.m. In Prep Girls Swimming, Iowa City High is at Dubuque Hempstead at 6 p.m. And in Men's College Golf, the University of Dubuque, Loras College, and Clark at the Loras College Invite, time to be announced. In the People Etc. section of the Telegraph Herald, today's birthdays include that of actor Sophia Loren, who turns 87. Rock musician Chuck Panazzo will be 73. Actor Tony Denison turns 72. Hockey Hall of Famer Guy Lafleur is 70. Actor Debbie Morgan is 70. Jazz musician Peter White is 67. Actor Betsy Brantley is 66. Actor Gary Cole is 65. TV news correspondent Deborah Roberts turns 61. And rock singers Gunnar and Matthew Nelson are 54. The winning Powerball numbers were 5, 36, 39, 45, and 57, with the Powerball 11 and Power Play 2. The jackpot, $457 million. In the almanac for today, September 20th, it's the 263rd day of 2021. There are 102 days left in the year. In 1519, Portuguese explorer Ferdinand Magellan and his crew set out from Spain on 5 ships to find a western passage to the Spice Islands. Magellan was killed en route, but one of his ships eventually circled the world. In 1881, Chester A. Arthur was sworn in as the 21st President of the United States, succeeding the assassinated James A. Garfield. In 1962, James Meredith, a black student, was blocked from enrolling at the University of Mississippi by Democratic Governor Ross R. Barnett. Meredith was later admitted. In 1967, the Cunard liner RMS Queen Elizabeth II was christened by Britain's Queen Elizabeth II in Clydebank, Scotland. And in 1973, in their so-called Battle of the Sexes, tennis star Billie Jean King defeated Bobby Riggs in straight sets 6-4, 6-3, 6-3 at the Houston Astrodome. In entertainment news, Eric Hogstrom of the Telegraph Herald writes, country star draws hundreds to Worthington. Tracy Byrd headlines Sunday's third annual Benefit the Vets event. Deb Feldman wears her love for Tracy Byrd on her sleeve and her leg, but she said she never expected the country star to perform in her small hometown. Quote, "That was the most exciting thing I heard when I heard he was coming to Worthington," Feldman said. Platinum-selling country artist Byrd headlined Sunday's third annual Benefit the Vets concert Sunday at Worthington Memorial Hall. Feldman, who now lives in Boscobel, Wisconsin, but comes from Worthington, participated in a meet-and-greet opportunity with Byrd prior to Sunday's show. She wore a shirt that declared that she is addicted to Byrd's music and has a tattoo of Byrd's name on her left leg. Quote, "I'm so excited. He's the nicest guy," said Feldman, who has seen Byrd perform about 10 times. Begun in 2018, the concert is a fundraiser for veterans and has previously featured country music artists the Bellamy Brothers and Mark Chestnut. The first two fundraising concerts raised about $30,000 total, with money supporting local veterans in need, Dubuque Honor Flight, and efforts to raise and train therapy dogs to help veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder. Organizer Darlene Frasher said planning for the concert takes months and requires more than 40 volunteers. Sunday's show drew a crowd of about 650 to Worthington, which has a population of about 380 people. Quote, "It's a lot of work, but I really enjoy it," Frasher said. "The first year, I remember local veterans sitting in the front row and dancing and having a really good time, and that just melted my heart," end quote. Efforts to host a concert in 2020 ran aground. Planned headliner Joe Diffie died in March 2020 due to COVID-19 complications. Quote, "We tried our darndest to get new entertainment, but most of them canceled their whole tours because of COVID," Frasher said. Plans to hold an outdoor version of the concert with two acts were ultimately scrapped because of the pandemic. Werner Helmer, a retired U.S. Marine Corps colonel, and his wife, Michelle, both of Durango, were attending their second Benefit the Vets concert on Sunday. Quote, "The people in this area really do a lot for veterans," said Werner Helmer, who was a part-time practicing attorney in Dyersville. Werner Helmer received a quilt during a so-called Quilts of Valor ceremony prior to Sunday's concert. Quote, "It's overwhelming. I did not expect it," he said. Byrd noted the significance of Sunday's event when speaking to the Telegraph Herald before taking the stage. Quote, "Veterans should be important to all of us, and I think mostly they are across the country," he said. "I hate it when I see them not being praised and thanked like they should be, so this event here has certainly been doing that for several years now. We're glad to be a part of it. They came in with flags this afternoon to practice their approach, and it made my goosebumps go up the back of my neck," end quote. Byrd said he looked forward to playing before the Worthington audience. Quote, "All my career I've played big places and small towns," he said. "I honestly probably have more fun in the small towns because of the intimacy of it, the way the people are, and usually the crowds are closer to you, and you can make better verbal contact and eye contact with them. Big shows, sometimes you can't see past the second or third rows because the lights are in your eyes," end quote. Doctors Oz and Roizen column is titled, "Do You Need a Booster Shot?" Here are the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's guidelines and definition of moderately to severely immunocompromised, plus why it's important to act now. Others will get a booster shot soon, around 6 to 8 months after initial vaccinations. First, get a booster that's the same brand, Moderna or Pfizer, that you got originally. Wait at least 28 days after your second injection before getting a booster. Third, you qualify as immunocompromised if you've been receiving cancer treatment for a solid or blood cancer, have had an organ transplant and are taking immune-suppressing medication, have received a stem cell transplant within the past 2 years, you are diagnosed with moderate or severe primary immunodeficiency, you have an advanced or untreated HIV infection, or are being treated with high-dose corticosteroids or any other immune-suppressing medication. The booster ups your resistance to COVID-19 to a more robust level of effectiveness. If you do contract COVID-19, the booster may help reduce the severity. Don't compromise your health if you're immunocompromised. Check in with your doctor about a booster today. In Monday's comics section, the Baby Blues column features the father and son. The son saying, "I don't know what I want to be when I grow up." The father says, "You'll probably be a hardworking taxpayer with a steady job and a family of your own, like me." The son says, "Is there an option B?" In the Family Circus cartoon, Dolly is holding flowers toward her little brother, saying, "Smell them, PJ. You'll really like their flavor." Today's Amy Dickinson column is titled, "Denying Child's Identity, a Rejection." Dear Amy, my child came out to my husband and me as non-binary, using they-them pronouns and a new name. I am struggling to change the way I address them, but I am honestly trying. My husband is not. My husband flat out told them that he doesn't care if they identify differently, he will continue to use their birth name and pronouns. My husband says he doesn't care what other people call them and that there is no negative connotation meant on his part, but I know it is and will be taken that way. I told him that my child may refuse to interact with him if he refuses to address them in this new way, but he says he doesn't care. His partial acceptance confuses me on what to do. Based on previous discussions, I believe my child will keep in touch with me, but not my husband, but I always said I would leave my husband if he showed hate to a child of mine. This situation is confusing because this isn't rejection, it's just not really acceptance. Should I leave him? Signed, Torn. Dear Torn, I'm going to dodge the direct question regarding whether you should leave your husband because it is too binary. And marriage, like gender and sexuality, occurs across a spectrum. When someone says, quote, "This is who I am, this is my name, this is my identity," end quote, and another person responds, quote, "No, it isn't," end quote. That's basically the definition of rejection. Many people in your and also my generation would freely admit to struggling adjusting to non-binary gender and they-them pronouns. I think it's natural to be thrown off when a child who you have raised with one identity announces such a change. But accepting someone's right to define their own personhood and identity is what it means to love someone. So, while addressing your child differently might be hard at first, accepting them should be easy. Should you leave him? I don't know. Maybe he needs more time to accept what is actually a very simple human right, the right to self-determination. But is his response hateful? I believe it is. In a second letter, Dear Amy, recently a very good friend of over 20 years took an overnight road trip with me. We have been through everything together. His breakups, the death of my husband, travels, you name it. After this last trip, he refused to return my calls or texts. Finally, he texted me and said, "I am having a hard time getting over this last trip. I wanted to call you, but I knew it would be too emotional to discuss it. I'm sure you don't remember what you did, but I can't forget." End quote. Amy, I was dumbfounded. I immediately texted him, apologizing for whatever it was, asking him to please let me know what I did to upset him. I did this numerous times with no response until he texted back, quote, "Soon I'll let you know," end quote. At this point, I want to text him and say, quote, "You are a lucky, lucky man to have so many close friends that you can afford to toss one away with no explanation," end quote. What do I do? Signed, Scratching My Head in California. Dear Scratching, your pal texted, quote, "I'm sure you don't remember what you did," end quote. So he knows you don't remember what you did to offend him, but he also won't fill you in. His behavior has effectively made you the wounded party now, and I agree with your current sentiment toward him. I do wish you two would be brave enough to at least hash this out verbally, however, versus trading cryptic texts. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Monday, September 20th, 2021. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. It may surprise you to know that the garbage that leaves your house will be preserved for centuries in a landfill. More than a dump, landfills are an engineered storage system. On the bottom, there's a thick plastic membrane and a layer of compacted clay to keep liquids from entering the groundwater. Above that, the fill area is divided into cells for each day's garbage. As trucks dump garbage into the cell, it's compacted to become as small as possible. At the end of the day, the cell is closed off with a layer of soil and perhaps another layer of plastic, making it water and airtight. Most garbage won't break down in this environment, though anaerobic bacteria will digest food and organic waste and produce methane, also known as natural gas, the same kind you burn in your stove. Because it's flammable, the methane has to be flared off, or it can be collected and sold for industrial use, or used to run electric generators at the landfill. America leads the world by a wide margin in garbage production, with more than 1,400 pounds per person per year. More than half of it ends up in landfills. And 65% of that is packaging: cardboard, paper, plastic, bottles, and cans, nearly all of which could have been recycled. On average, recycling costs about half as much as storing garbage in a landfill. So if you'd like to reduce your garbage footprint and your city's municipal waste cost, recycling is the way to go. I'm Scott Tinker, filling you with fun facts on Earth Date.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.